Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Live in the Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. We're here till 4. We've got some famous animals to talk about. Where are they now? Today in history, Dracula, the book was released in London. And so we're going to talk about the scariest book you ever read. 312-981-7200. We play classic Johnny Carson. You can watch the Johnny Carson show every night on Antenna TV. So we play little highlights every morning at 2:30. We're going to play some Joan Rivers as a guest host in 1984. All right. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. My guest right now is a good friend of the show's. And we're always happy to have him on. If you have any space-related questions or concerns, 312-981-7200, because Rod Pyle is our guest. He's an author, a journalist, editor-in-chief at Ad Astra Magazine, and joins us once a month to talk all things space. 312-981-7200. Hello, Rod.
Hey, Nick. So I have a question.
Yeah.
If it's not a question by somebody, what would a space concern be, do you suppose?
We've had people call about being concerned about certain things, you know, like things falling.
True lights in the sky and stuff. Yeah, things, yeah, you're right.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. So,
okay, well, so much for me being a smarty pants.
Well, give everybody the background on Rod Pyle.
The old patented rundown. So yeah. I was born a little bit before the space age. I don't want to say exactly how much, but about a year. And grew up watching NASA in its glory days, as many people would call it, certainly in the golden era of the space age. So I kind of became aware of all this stuff. Even as a little kid, I was fascinated by rockets, but I really began to understand the Gemini program and how it was leading the Apollo program, that we were going to the moon when that was going on. And, of course, just studying everything I could learn about it in Life magazine and on the news and what limited media we had then, which if you weren't alive then and you're young today, you have no idea.
Right.
You had to go in a library and pull out these 3-foot-long drawers full of cards to find a book. And so grew up watching those things, saw the first successful landing on Mars with machine, Viking 1, which was a very moving moment, and knew I wanted to do that, but the advanced mathematics kind of was a little bit of a challenge. So after studying astronomy and geology for a couple of years, I decided to go into science media instead. And I've kind of been doing that ever since. So I worked in documentaries, and I worked on visual effects for Star Trek and Battlestar Galactica, and a couple of pilots that didn't go anywhere, but a really bad movie. And then got into documentaries with History Channel Discovery, and then in 2003 started writing books, and now I do that and edit a magazine for the National Space Society. Thank you for touting that, called Ad Astra, which is now available by subscription on Amazon.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's very cool. It's a great magazine, too, Ad Astra. Yeah, it's a
great
magazine. What was the bad movie you worked on?
It was called Warlord Battle for the Galaxy. It was Joe Dante's attempt at a big pilot that was going to be a series, and then they said, no, we'll make it a movie. And I was, I believe, the 5th visual effects supervisor on it. I started with the 4th supervisor, and then he had to go back to Trek, so I stayed on to finish this thing. And, you know, it was kind of, Joe Dante's a talented guy, but it was kind of an unimaginative riff on Star Wars and swords and sandals and stuff. And it had Rod Taylor in it, but he was old, and he had a bald spot. And the spaceship, I kid you not, the Starship Osiris looked like Flipper. It looked like a dolphin. It was just embarrassing in so many ways. And so we'd kind of slink home at the end of the day with our tail between our legs, like, I can't believe we're working on this thing. And, you know, he tried. I mean, they really did try to make it a good show, spend a lot of money on it, but it just didn't work out.
Oh, that's too bad. And I happen to be a really huge fan of Joe Dante's.
Yeah, it was originally called The Osiris Chronicles. That's what most people knew it by. And then when they repurposed it as a TV movie, it became Warlord's Battle for the Galaxy, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and, you know, there's this young girl who's, I think, 11 years old, this young blonde kid, but she happens to be the best pilot on Alderaan or whatever the heck the name of the planet was. It wasn't Alderaan or something like that. Caliban 9.
Huh.
And so, you know, she's the very best we've got. She's 9 years old. So she's in the starship in what looks like one of those kind of cool hanging wicker basket chairs with controls on it, and the chair pivots around to stay independent of the spaceship. It was just everything about it. You kind of looked at it and thought, this looks like Disneyland in 1968. You know, it was very odd.
Is it out there available for consumption, right?
Unfortunately, you can still find copies on VHS and clips on YouTube, but mercifully, there's only a little bit. I actually did find it once in its entirety, but I think it had been dubbed into Czech or something like that, Hungarian. So it certainly wasn't any worse, you know, or at least the voices were a little more animated.
Yeah.
Scratchy, singy, you know.
Yeah.
That's pretty funny.
That's pretty funny.
Oh, God.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
My proud visual effects career.
Yeah. Well, no, you worked on a lot of good stuff, though.
Yeah, there was good stuff. And actually, it was funny. I was after watching Independence Day the other night with my son, because we wanted to romp, and I thought of you. I said, I got to show you one episode of Star Trek Next Generation. He said, okay. He said, did you work on it? I said, no, but I was around and they were doing it. I was hanging out. And it was Conspiracy. Do you remember that one?
No.
It was late in season one of Star Trek The Next Generation, and the first two seasons they were really struggling trying to figure out what the show was going to be. You know, was it Roddenberry's utopian vision and social issues, or was it cowboys in space? And, you know, Roddenberry was starting to fade a little bit, and that whole ethos was starting to go with him. But they had still been pretty pat and kind of tame episodes, so the writers said, we want to do something real different. So they did an episode called Conspiracy, where basically these little purple cockroaches are crawling into various high-ranking officers in the Federation and taking over their brains and making them do awful things because they're preparing for an invasion of purple cockroaches to take over all of humanity. So gradually, the crew of the Enterprise figure this out, and they go down. They actually go back to Earth, and it's taken root on Earth. And they end up saving the day because they find the hive master who's, you know, filled with a bigger purple cockroach inside. And so they turn their phasers on him and blow him away. Well, so, you know, this was more action than any eight episodes of Star Trek had before this, right? Mm-hmm. At least of the Next Generation. So to make a long story short, they turn the phasers on him. This is still the physical effects days. So they packed a fake head full of hamburger and pig intestines and stuff,
right,
and the upper torso with all this junk, filled it with detonator cord. So when they phased him, they set it off, it blew apart and covered the inside of the stage with rotting meat for a couple of weeks. The viewers were not pleased.
No.
And they wrote in droves saying, my kid was watching that show last night. This is before they had TV ratings up.
Yeah.
And you completely violated every tenet of Star Trek I ever believed in, and we hate you, and blah, blah, blah. So, of course, we enjoyed that very much.
That's funny. All right, Rod, hang on, okay?
You bet.
All right, there. Rod Pyle is with us. If you have any space questions, 312-981-7200. We got a lot of space stories to get to in the news, and it's always fun to talk to Rod. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Hi, Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Skyline studio here on a Tuesday morning, despite the fact that it feels like a Monday. It is Tuesday, and we're here until 4 o'clock, as we are every weekday morning, 11 p.m. to 4 a.m. One of our regular guests, one of our favorite guests, is Rod Pyle. He's an author, journalist, editor-in-chief at Ad Astra Magazine, and a space specialist. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you have a space question, and Rod is here. Hi, Rod.
Hey.
Hey. So let's talk about this. There's the NASA. NASA.
Very good. Are we reading this?
I don't even understand what's going on now. NASA and SpaceX are a go for a Wednesday launch.
Yeah, so this is the Demo 2 mission, and this is the culmination of roughly a decade of efforts, including what's called Commercial Crew Program, which was kind of initiated under Obama. Well, it was initiated under Obama, I should say. And the idea was, look, let's not do what we've been doing for so long with NASA, which is they design it, they hire contractors to build it, they worry about every little detail and have very invasive inspectors and all that, and then NASA owns it, flies it, and incurs great expenses. Maybe we can do better by capitalizing on the best private industry. So SpaceX stepped up early, Boeing stepped up early, and they said, okay, we'll build spaceships, and in SpaceX's case, they said we'll also build rockets. So they've both been kind of racing each other, Boeing and SpaceX, the finish line here. Within a couple months of each other, they flew test flights earlier this year. And Boeing's didn't go so well. They had a bunch of problems. We talked about that, I think, one or two appearances ago.
Yeah.
Software errors and stuff that could have scotched the mission and possibly hurt the astronauts. So they're kind of on stand down, and they're going to have to fly a second demo mission at their own expense, which they offered to do to give them credit. Meanwhile, SpaceX had a very successful unmanned demonstration mission. So now on Wednesday, or Saturday if Wednesday doesn't work out, they're going to launch two astronauts, first crewed launch from U.S. soil since 2011.
Hmm.
And so we're kind of back in the space business, and we get to once again deliver our astronauts on our rockets to what is largely our space station, because we paid for something over half of it. It is international in orientation and in expenditures and building, but an awful lot of it was the U.S. and the shuttle that put a lot of it together. So it's nice to be able to do it ourselves. So during the interim, we've been buying seats on the Russian Soyuz capsule, which is very small, rather elderly, although it works very well. It's very robust. But they're $85 million apiece. When we started this in 2011, they were $32
million. Wow.
Now they're in the 80s. So it's still probably cheaper than the shuttle, but it's expensive. So Elon Musk rides in as a white horse and says, I'll do it. So, yeah, this is the first time, and we all got our fingers crossed, and it is going to be so great when this works. I'm really, really excited.
Who are the astronauts that are going up?
Bob Behnken and Doug Hurley. So both these guys are pilots, of course, because, you know, when you're going to do, like, one of these premier missions, you want to put your best foot forward. They're both married to female astronauts. Hurley has a bachelor's degree in, I think, engineering. Behnken is interesting, and they're co-commanders, so we don't have this commander-pilot thing going on. They are co-commanders, mm-hmm. So they're both in charge. And if you've ever seen the inside of the Dragon capsule, it's really big for two guys. It's designed to fly up to seven people.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're in there by yourself, as I was briefly once, it's like, wow, this is a little aluminum room with glass panels and all kinds of cool buttons. Oh, don't touch that one. Anyway, Behnken, who's also married to an astronaut, as I said, has a bachelor's in physics, a bachelor's in engineering, and a master's and PhD in engineering from Caltech.
Jeez.
It just makes me wilt, you know? So these are the guys going up, and they've been training with the SpaceX gear in various ways. They've been involved in training and overseeing things for about 6 years, I think. So they're well acquainted with the hardware, and the thing, in theory, can fly autonomously through most of the mission. But, of course, they're pilots, so they're not going to probably let that happen. I imagine at some point they'll take over.
You know, in the article that I'm looking at here, they actually have the schedule for what's going on with these guys.
Oh, down at the bottom, yeah.
Yeah.
It's 19 hours after they launch to get to that thing. That's a long day.
Yeah. Jeez.
That's like flying to Australia with two changes, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's going to be a patience-shredding day. If they don't launch then, because at this point they got a 40 to 60% chance, they think, of the weather being favorable, then they'll launch on Saturday, which will unfortunately conflict with something I'm trying to do, but that's the way it goes.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll keep an eye on that. An interesting story right there.
There is one more part of this, which is because of the pandemic, of course, astronauts are always quarantined for a week to 14 days before a flight. I think at this point it's a week. There was a little ruffle before they left for the Cape because somebody posted on Twitter that they saw the astronauts driving down to catch their flight to Florida in a pickup truck with the windows rolled down. Mm. Oh, my God, they're going to get infected. Well, you know, if people aren't sneezing right in the window, it's probably not a factor. But they did quarantine. However, NASA has closed the Cape to all but a handful of VIPs, and I know a number of reporters that were lined up to attend the launch have now been told thanks, but no thanks. So, of course, the public can still go as long as they're outside of NASA. You know, NASA can't do anything about people standing out on the beaches and on the strip of sand, you know, 4 miles away from the launch site and all that. Unfortunately, the sheriff of Brevard County, which is where Kennedy Space Center is located, has basically said, hey, America's a free country, come on down. So the businesses are opening and there's going to be a lot of people there.
Wow.
And, you know, here's to hoping that they don't make each other sick.
Yeah. Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, let's talk a little bit about this, a similar thing that we're just talking about, obviously, how SpaceX and NASA are launching astronauts into space during a pandemic. What are the details on that?
Well, that was kind of it. You know, just that they were a little extra careful about the quarantine. They are going to test both astronauts multiple times before they launch. Temperature checks, swabs with a really fast test. A little more careful about the quarantine. But the main story there was just the fact that NASA basically slammed the door on everybody except the top government VIPs and said, hey, you know, we're glad you're trying to cover the mission to stay home. And NASA does not want people jamming shoulder to shoulder in the viewing areas outside of their property, but there's nothing they can do about that. And like I said, the local law enforcement has said, I'm really not going to lift a finger. Come enjoy yourselves. This is America. So we've got a culture clash there. But flying during a pandemic, you're right. I mean, there's some concern here because you're going up the space station. You sure don't want people getting sick up there at the same time. They do have a couple of Soyuz capsules and then the Crew Dragon, which is the SpaceX capsule. So they could get them all home in pretty short order. But you don't want people getting sick up there. And it's interesting, I commissioned for the magazine when it started ramping up. I have a really fine writer named John Cross, who's an MD. And I asked him to write an article on virology and pandemics and infections in space. And I didn't really understand quite as much as he explained. I haven't published it yet, but basically people get weaker and viruses get stronger. So you've got a graph with lines crossing in a direction that's absolutely the opposite of what you want. So moving ahead, just looking at this as kind of a springboard, we're going to have to be really careful on these long-term missions to figure out ways to mediate this stuff. Of course, you don't have wet markets on a spaceship, so that's not going to happen. But things can still occur, so it's going to be tricky.
So the last time a rocket was launched from U.S. soil, nearly 1 million people gathered to watch. What do we think about what's going to happen, you know, for this new launch?
Yeah, so you're talking about the last time we launched a crew?
Yeah.
The shuttle?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a big one. I was there. It was packed. I don't know, you know, because the shuttle is a more spectacular launch because it was much bigger and much heavier and a much better show. I mean, SpaceX launches are great, but this is a much smaller rocket. And if you've ever seen the Falcon, instead of a wow, it's kind of a, oh, that's cool. So I think had the pandemic not occurred, yeah, we'd probably be looking at 1.4 million, 1.5 million, something like that. With this going on, hundreds of thousands, maybe dozens of thousands. I just don't have any way of knowing because I don't really know. You know, I'm trying to sort of keep my tab on what's going on in local culture by people. I know they're, you know, near Cocoa Beach and so forth, but it's just too early to tell. But on Tuesday night, we'll probably see the traffic back up. And I mean, we've already seen this weekend, people aren't going to rocket launches. They're just going out. So, you know, given that impulse, I think it might be pretty crowded.
Yeah. I mean, people are going out. There's no question about it. I mean, here locally, our beaches are closed here in Chicago, but that didn't stop people from going over the border in Indiana, where the beaches are open.
Oh.
And they went by hundreds. I mean, you know, I saw some of the images, and the beaches were packed. And people were trying to stay 6 feet away from each other, you know, and all that stuff. But it's a lot of people wanted to get out, and they did.
Well, up where I am in Northeast LA, we have, because we're right up against the foothills of the San Gabriel Mountains, there's a hiking area here called Eaton Canyon, which is basically a wash. I mean, it's only called nature because in LA that's the best we've got, right? But it looks like somebody dropped an atom bomb and then let some scrub brush grow. But it goes up into some pretty hiking areas, and apparently today and yesterday, from what they saw, it made national news. It was packed shoulder to shoulder with people, and admittedly, you're outside. But they're either not wearing masks, or my favorite, the new normal for a lot of folks is, I'm wearing a mask, but it's pulled down below my nose.
See, now I see people walking down the street with doing that, and I'm like, what's the purpose of even wearing one if you're going to do that?
I guess they think that way they're not spitting on you, but I don't think they understand that it's just the respiratory process. It's not just saliva. It's anything that's coming out of your lungs.
Yeah.
So it is puzzling. But what are you going to say?
Yeah.
Hey,
right.
Buddy.
Yeah.
You're endangering the astronauts. Cut it out.
Yeah. Okay. All right, Rod, hang on.
You bet.
All right, Rod Pyle is with us. Always great to talk to him. If you have any space-related questions, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Author, journalist, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra Magazine. We'll continue talking about space stories right here on WGN. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, here until 4, as we are every weekday morning. 4 o'clock, we head over to Bradley Place to the TV side of WGN, get some early morning news from that great crew, and then Bob Surratt has your morning drive starting at 5. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. If you want to jump in here, we're talking with Rod Pyle from Ad Astra Magazine. He's a great author and a space expert, and we're talking about some space news stories. And if you have questions, we would love to hear from you. Phone lines are open at 312-981-7200. All right, Rod, we're back.
So I hear you've been at WGN for a while.
Yeah, tomorrow, actually, marks my 35th year. With
man,
yeah,
you still look like you're 28 years old. How's that even possible?
Well, I started when I was young. I was, I was 19, I think, when I first 19 on the verge of 20 when I first joined up with the late great Roy Leonard on his show to review movies, and that's how it started. And it's been 35
that's
years.
Cool.
Yeah, yeah. So tomorrow's the anniversary.
Congratulations!
Thanks, man. I appreciate that. It's been I love this place and I love this job, and you know, and it's been great. It's just been great. So, all right, Rod, let's get back to some of these space stories, shall we?
Yeah, sure. Right,
this is not a great story, but Virgin Orbit's first launch attempt fails.
Yeah, so Virgin Galactic, as you know, is Richard Branson's space liner, which he bought from Burt Rutan back in 2004. Actually, Rutan stayed on for a while. And this was to get the X Prize for something that could fly and land and fly again in a certain period of time. And so it's this weird kind of... hey, this guy looks like a lawn dart with extra long wings that kind of fold up during reentry to slow it down. Mm-hmm. So it was very successful for the X Prize. And so Branson logically thought, well, I'm going to pump money in this company and I'm going to make it a tourist enterprise. Turned out to be a lot harder than it looked. So estimates were it would fly in 2007. They're still trying to get their first revenue flights going, but to get it close. So that's the human side. In the midst of that, some of the folks, and I think it was probably the brainchild of a guy named George Whitesides, who actually used to run the National Space Society before he went on to be with Virgin Galactic, said, you know, let's start also doing cargo service because we could use another line of revenue. So I created a company, which I've since gone off, called Virgin Orbit. And it is basically a 747 that carries a rocket under one wing, kind of like the B-52 used to carry the X-15 up to high altitudes. Going upward at a very steep trajectory, and then they release that rocket, and it continues on and goes into orbit while the 747 comes back and lands. So it's a great design. It's a great idea. It's a much cheaper way to do things. You can launch 1,000 pounds of orbit for about $12 million, which is unheard of in terms of cheap for this kind of thing, especially for a dedicated launch. So today was the premier effort to try and make orbit, but apparently... The aircraft flew fine. They got up to altitude. They released the rocket, and it ignited and ran for a bit, and then the engine pooped out, and it came back down to Earth without making orbit. So they were two-thirds successful, depending on how you look at it.
Mm-hmm. Now, how big a setback is this?
I don't think too big. You know, they always build these things, at least from when I've talked to them, they're always getting ready to fly one and building at least one more. So I think they've got another one just about ready to go. And, you know, they're ginning up to be in full business mode this year and next. So I don't think it's a big setback. And really, for the engineers, it's like, well, you know, items one and two out of three work. So we didn't make orbit, but we did get up to altitude before we separated. It separated successfully. The engine ignited. And that's most of the fight right there. You know, at that point, you just want the engine to keep burning and head pointed up in the right direction, which is up into orbit. So it's a lot of good data. They'll have to look at it. It'll slow them down a little bit because you got to evaluate it and see what happened. But it could have been something as simple as a valve or a cracked piece of circuitry. It could be a lot of things. So we'll just have to see what they find out. But they do need some good news pretty soon. And as I understand, although I'm a little fuzzy on this story, I think Branson, because of the pandemic and financial woes, had to separate himself from either a big part of Virgin Galactic or maybe both operations. It's a drag. Or it's at least being considered. I'm not sure what happened there. But the company, by the way, did go big time into building ventilators about a month and a half ago.
Oh, they did.
And so, yeah, so they've been building some fairly advanced stuff. And also, JPL announced, Jet Propulsion Laboratory, the NASA facility out here, announced about 3 weeks ago that they had built not just a ventilator, but a high-pressure, really adaptable, you know, top-end thing for the sickest patients that they basically said, okay, here's the design, here's the tooling, here's how you make it. You know, it's a gift. Go, go, go. So that was really wonderful of both outfits to do that.
Mm. All right. That's great. Now, and I love that it's they call it Cosmic Girl.
Well, that was actually the name of the plane while it was still in service.
Oh, I see.
Because normally he's got this, you know, on the Virgin Galactic side, it's White Knight 1 and Starship 1, or White Knight 1 and Starship 2. And then on this side, it was going to be, they were going to have a similar White Knight, which is a weird, big, weird plane with two hulls and cantilever wings and stuff. But they said, you know what, let's just use the 747. So they pulled one from the Virgin fleet. And then the launcher is, the rocket itself is called Launcher One, so it kind of preserves that part of it. But yeah, it's Cosmic Girl with that great nose art that he always commissioned on his planes.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty cool.
It is cool. Yeah.
All right. Okay. So it's that. It's not going to be that big of, as you said, it's not going to be that big of a setback then.
I don't think so. I mean, these days, you know, commercial space is moving along very quickly. There's always a mixture of fact and a little bit of optimism, if I may say it that way. So I'm pretty sure we're getting the straight story, but we'll find out. You know, sometimes things are a little worse than we're told, and you got to go tisk, tisk, tisk and find out what the real story is. I think that certainly happened with Boeing over the last year and a half.
Mm.
But, you know, I think from what I know about Virgin and George Whitesides, who's the president of this operation, you know, he's always been pretty straightforward and transparent, and he brings it to the table. So he's a really good guy. So I think probably they're giving us the story as they know it. You know, they got to start digging around and find out what really happened.
Yeah.
But the other thing is, it's, you know, it's a $12 million launcher, so it's not like you've lost a Saturn V or a shuttle or something. There are no people on it, and it's just a robotic rocket that's delivering satellites. And you kind of figure, the general math is on these things, even with Elon Musk and the Falcon Heavy, he said, I give it a 50-50 chance. And that's kind of the accepted math. You cross your fingers and hope on the coin flip that it works. So this time it didn't, but it will.
Just a general question. Are there webcasts where you can see these launches? People can watch them, correct?
Yeah, generally space.com will carry this stuff. There's a number of Facebook Live and YouTube Live casts, and then usually the companies, so SpaceX, Blue Origin usually shows theirs later. I don't remember if they showed the last few live or not. I think they did. But SpaceX always shows them live, and Virgin will show either clips or the whole thing. But space.com is probably the best place to go because they're really up on this stuff. Yeah. And they're a partner of ours.
Space.com. There you go. Did you watch this launch?
I didn't. You know, I was so wrapped up. I'm getting ready to do this kind of weird sci-fi talk on Saturday, so my week's been kind of consumed with that, so I missed the whole thing.
Well, let's talk about what you just mentioned there. We've got spacecraft in science fiction with the three Spacketeers.
Yes, it's kind of embarrassing. So it's myself and a wonderful space artist and former engineer named Aldo Spadoni, and one of the art staff on Star Trek, a number of Star Trek franchises, named Rick Sternbach, who I actually never met when I was working on Deep Space Nine, but I always heard about him mentioned these sort of revering, hushed tones, like, that's a Rick Sternbach design.
Yeah.
This is a Sternbach guy. So I finally met him about 5 years ago, and he's just a wonderful guy. We knew a lot of the same people. So we do this series of talks for the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, the West Coast chapter, Los Angeles, Las Vegas chapter. So they said, you know, can you do something about sort of the move of spaceships, first starships, now we're just saying spaceships because it encompasses more, from science fiction to reality? And we said, sure. So I kind of kick it off with a historical talk about, you know, the first spaceships in sci-fi and how they evolved and past the goofy Buck Rogers stuff, and then really get serious in the 1950s and some of those great old movies you all remember, like Destination Moon and Conquest of Space. And then Star Trek comes and changes everything, and Star Wars comes and changes everything again. And then I hand off to these guys, and they talk more about how they've designed spaceships and done the paintings and done the production art and influenced heavily the design of what we see in television and movies. So normally this is a live thing, but we're doing it virtually online. So if people are interested, as much as I dread saying it, if you look up Three Spaceketeers and Rod Pyle, you'll find our talk listing. And it's free.
It's free. Okay. It's Pacific time from 1 to 4 p.m. on Saturday.
Yeah. Yeah, so your time, I guess, 3 to 5, right?
Yeah, that's right. Okay.
PM.
Spacecraft.
We're not early morning guys.
No, I gotcha. So, spacecraft in science fiction with the three Spacketeers. That sounds like a lot of fun.
Did you see the graphic?
No.
Oh, you gotta look. It's got every sci-fi visual trope there ever was, and the three of us down in the foreground looking very merry in our kind of cartoony space helmets. It's really fits the whole Space Cadets thing, you know?
All right, well, we'll have to check out that graphic.
I mean, branding is shameless, right?
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's true. It's true. Tom, can you get me a photo of that? Get me a copy of that so I get to see it. So, again, this is Saturday from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. Pacific. And it's the three Space Cadets with spacecraft and science fiction. That's always a lot of fun to talk about how the spacecraft in movies and TV has evolved.
It is, and you'll be pleased to know that there is a lot of respect accorded. I got very quiet. There's a lot of respect accorded for the Ranger and the other stuff out of Interstellar. and I said, do it for my pal Nick, and they said okay, because you know I get my licks in, but honest to God, that part of that movie, I mean, besides I thought the designs were pretty good for everything except that weird shuttlecraft that landed on Planet X with, you know, magic fuel that you didn't see any fuel tanks or anything, but the Ranger, that was the name of the main ship, right?
Yeah,
I
can't remember.
Yeah. And they were all physical effects. That wasn't CGI. The only CGI was the Saturn V launch at the beginning. All that other stuff was miniatures, and nobody does that anymore. It just looked fantastic.
Yeah. All right. Well, all right, Rod, hang on, okay?
You bet.
Rod Pyle is with us. Always a lot of fun to talk with Rod. If you have any questions or anything about space, give us a call. Phone lines are open. We'd love to hear from you. 312-981-7200. And again, you can join Rod and his fellow Space Cadets talking about spacecraft and science fiction, and it's on Saturday afternoon from 1 to 4 p.m. Pacific time. So there you can go, space.com, if you want to check that out. Okay, 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you want to jump in here with any and all of your space-related questions. Nick DeGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago on a Tuesday morning. Coming up, we're going to talk about the scariest books you've ever read, because on this date in history, Dracula went on sale. And we're going to talk about famous animals as well. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you want to join us. And the news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Our good friend Rod Pyle is our guest right now. He is an author, a journalist, editor-in-chief at Ad Astra Magazine. He joins us once a month to talk space. And if you have a question, 312-981-7200. Welcome back, Rod.
Thanks. You know, I've come to the conclusion that I enjoy doing this show way more than Thanksgiving.
Oh, come on now.
Yeah, I really do. I mean, that may say something about my family, but...
No, I love having you on, man. It's always a blast. It's always informative, and it's always very popular. By the way, I'm looking at that image. And you've got you guys look fantastic in your helmets for this event that's on Saturday. Boy, you really have a lot of sci-fi represented in the background there.
Yeah, that was I kind of mocked up like a really crummy version of it. I said, "Hey Aldo, what do you think?" And he said, "Ooh, let me run with that." So he did that great montage of everything. And much to my pleasure, I didn't ask him for it, but I looked up in the upper right, and there was the Martian war machine from War of the Worlds, 1953, and I thought, God, I love you.
Yeah, that's pretty so, great. I also love the fact that Dune is included.
Oh, I guess it was, yeah.
Yeah.
That didn't even strike me, yeah. And I think he has Dave Earson still in there somewhere, doesn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's pretty much all covered. It's a really cool image, so that's going to be
so
fun.
So this is what happens when you're dealing with the fanatic geek squad, you know? Yeah. It's like, oh, we got to get everything in there.
Yeah, it's fun. It's really fun to spot all that stuff. So, yeah, very, very, very cool image. All right. Let's get to another story here, but we do have a phone call someone with a question. If you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. This is Sheila on WGN. Hi, Sheila.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to ask about the Bronson guy. You know, I hear two different things about him. One is space travel, and the other thing with the satellite, they're saying that he's putting on some kind of satellite or what have not. But, you know, we had that spooky thing with the drones a couple of weeks. It wasn't last month where that was pretty spooky. You know, they were launching that, you know, in space. So is he trying to put satellites up there? Is that in competition with the other whatever that other billionaire or millionaire guy, I think billionaire, who's trying to do that with the internet. Is there something going on with that? Do you know?
Yeah, I do. So what you're talking about, there aren't a lot of millionaires in the space trade anymore because you either become a billionaire or you become a thousandaire and you're not in anymore. So, yeah, Elon Musk a few weeks ago launched his Starlink satellite. So there was a big flock of those that went up that I think you saw over Chicago. So that gave a lot of people pause. I think it was 80 satellites. And he's got, I think, 480 up now, and he's planning to have many tens of thousands, maybe as many as 40,000 up by the time he's done. And those are to provide internet service to people all over the planet. So wherever you are on the planet Earth, if you have a base station, you'll be able to get internet from above. So if you're in rural Africa or the Arctic Circle or something like that, you'll be able to get broadband. So that's what he's doing. What Richard Branson is doing with Virgin Galactic and Virgin Orbit is really more working for customers. So Elon Musk, in a lot of sense, is his own customer. He does work with NASA, but he's launching his own rockets. He's going to launch people. He's going to do all this stuff. Virgin Galactic is set up to launch tourists up into, not quite into orbit. It's a big hop, but you do get weightless, and you see space for about 7 to 12 minutes. Yeah. And then the one I was talking about with the rocket that drops off the airplane is strictly to launch just small satellites, but just one or two or a few at a time. Yeah.
So, okay, Sheila.
Okay, thanks. All right.
Thanks for the question.
No problem. Okay. Thank you. Yep. I'm joining you.
Okay. All right, Rod, we got more space stories to talk about here.
Yeah, we do.
The NASA's head of human spaceflight resigns.
Yes, this is Doug Lavero, and he hadn't been there that long, but he's known and much loved in the space community. And it was a real shocker to most of us. I don't think anybody knew this was coming. And the timing wasn't great because, you know, it's right before this Demo 2 launch. And he had been, to some large degree, responsible for this decision-making on this recent story, which I think we talked about last time, that NASA is hiring, again, commercial companies to build their lunar landers, the Artemis mission, which is to return American man and woman to the moon by 2024.
Right.
So Blue Origin, which is Jeff Bezos' company, and their so-called national team, which includes a couple of other companies, including Lockheed Martin, are going to build one design. SpaceX is going to build their single-stage design, and then Dynetics is the third company building theirs. Something happened in there, and it's not clear what. Lavero said something about, you know, making a decision that he thought better of later. There's, you know, of course, the rumor mill is grinding along. If you were to come to me and say, Rod, what do you think the cause was here? There's a certain large contractor that didn't get a deal on that decision that I think might have had some influence, but, you know, you don't like to speak out of turn, and it may not be the case, but I'm willing to bet eventually if we do hear anything about it, it's going to be, there is pressure applied either directly or indirectly through Congress. And it's a shame because he was doing a great job. NASA's definitely going the right direction. But as always, when you're spending a lot of money on something like this, there's going to be certain parties that are unhappy, and those parties are in districts that have congressmen, and who knows? You know, that's just a guess. And I'd just be very clear, that's strictly a guess. That is not a National Space Society position. That is just my opinion.
Okay. Wow. Yeah. So how is this going to affect anything further going ahead?
That's a good question. The hope is that it won't. And NASA's pretty modular, you know, and they've already got a former astronaut named Ken Bowersox taking that slot, at least for the interim. So I think they'll keep moving ahead. How it might affect things in a more informal basis is hard to say, you know, because there are a lot of relationships. It's not all cut and dried and quantitative. I mean, there's a lot of stuff and a lot of personality involved in some of these things. So it may, you know, it may cause a little bit of a ripple, but I think they're going to stay on schedule. The bigger question is, if Trump doesn't get a second term and Biden, let's say, gets in, what are the Democrats going to do? It's always been a puzzle to me that Apollo really started and got fire under it in a Democratic administration and then sort of withered, and we got the vastly scaled down space shuttle under the Nixon Republican administration. But ever since then, space seems to fare better under Republican administrations and is challenged under Democratic ones. So I'm hoping you know, it would really be unfortunate if we lost for the fourth or fifth time a lunar initiative where we've actually spent money and had a program running and then decide, now this isn't important, we're going to shut it down. Because I think at that point, the public's going to say, you know, we just don't believe you anymore. Mm-hmm. You're not going to do this. And then it's up to Mr. Musk and Mr. Bezos, largely.
Wow. Wow. And yeah. What's the future for Doug Levero? Does anybody know?
I don't know. He will land somewhere squarely on his feet. I mean, guys at that level, you know, when you're one of the top slots in NASA, you kind of have your pick of jobs.
Right,
so
sure.
I think he's going to do fine. And he's a good guy and people know it. So he'll land somewhere great. They haven't called me, by the way, about that job because they're smart. But it'll ultimately go to the right guy, I'm sure. And Levero will end up somewhere exactly right for him.
All right. There we go. Let's see. Big Ed, go ahead.
Hey, Nick.
Hey.
Hey, Rob.
Ed.
I might ask you a question. Actually, two questions. What is your most memorable launch you ever witnessed? And what's going on with Voyager 1 and Voyager 2?
Okay, so in order, I guess the most memorable launch I saw was the final shuttle launch, STS-135. Largely because it was the final launch. It was the second shuttle launch I had seen. And the shuttle was big and smoky and noisy and shook the ground. And, you know, the subsonic waves came over you and really kind of painted your insides against the back of your body. So it was a very visceral experience. I had the good fortune, because I'd been working on a project at the Johnson Space Center, I got it, what they call it, the launch director's invite or something. A wonderful friend named Jeannie Engel got me this invitation. And she also worked at Johnson. And so I was able to go sit in the bleachers, you know, with all the important people. So that was cool, because it's like being on a really nice cruise. You know, you pretend you're one of the rich folks by walking around the cruise ship and having the hors d'oeuvres at 4 o'clock. So that was a spectacular launch. Great fun. Very satisfying. And then, of course, after you see the launch, you go down to the museum and look at the Saturn V, the lunar module, all that stuff. So that was great. Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 are still speeding out beyond the solar system. Voyager 1 left, I think, in 2012. It takes a few years, as it turns out, to actually get out of the solar system, because there's this kind of zone. It's called the heliopause, but it's basically this zone. I mean, it's not a thing you can really see, but between where the pressure of all the radiation coming out from the sun, the light coming out from the sun, is pushed back on by stuff coming in from outside our solar system, so from the galaxy beyond. So there's this kind of dead zone between the two where they bash into each other. But it's more convoluted and complex than we thought. So it took both voyages a while to get through that, but they have crossed that boundary. They're in interstellar space, or the space between the stars, and they're heading off to long-term rendezvous with other star systems. Not intended. This is just where they're headed. It'll take about, I think, 40 to 80,000 years for them to get there. But, yeah, they're just drifting through space. We're still talking to both of them. They have nuclear fuel supplies on them. So it's a little bit like looking at a candle in Tokyo from San Francisco. But we do still communicate with them. There's still some instrumentation working, and they think they'll lose contact about 2025.
Okay, there you go. Rod, hang on. Big Ed, thanks for the call. We got the news coming up. Hello, it's Nick DiGilio on 720 WGN, live in the Skyline studio here until 4 o'clock. At 4 o'clock, we head over to Bradley Place to the TV side of WGN and get some news from that great group. And then the one, the only, Bob Surratt. Is here at 5 o'clock for your morning drive. And WGN is with you 24/7 to keep you informed, to keep you company, and to get you through this. And we will get through this together. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you have any space-related questions. We're going to talk about some famous animals and where are they now. So today in history, the novel Dracula went on sale in London. So we're going to talk about scariest books you've ever read. Classic Johnny Carson. You can watch the Johnny Carson show every night on Antenna TV, and it's great. And we're going to play back some Joan Rivers guest hosting in 1984. So this is all coming up, and if you want to get in here, it's 312-981-7200. The phone lines are open. And we're talking with Rod Pyle, author, journalist, editor-in-chief at Ad Astra Magazine, space expert, and we got more space stories to talk about. And if you have a space-related question, we would love to hear from you at 312-981-7200. Rod, welcome back.
Thanks, sir.
So you're looking forward to this event on Saturday, correct?
Yeah, we've done it once before, and it was a lot of fun. This time will be a little different. We're going to talk for less time. I think we talked for about 30 to 35 minutes each before, and then did a Q&A. We're going to try and keep it short, like 10, 15 minutes each, leave more time for Q&A, because it turns out people have a lot of questions about this stuff. And then if there's time, we'll each do another little kind of wrap-up presentation. But, mm-hmm. I mean, how much more it's like when you and I talk about sci-fi movies. You know, how much more fun can you have?
Yeah.
There's just so much great stuff out there.
Yeah. So what? Let me ask you, what do you think of the special effects now with the CGI and everything? Do you prefer the old school?
Well, I mean, it's natural for guys my age to say, it's not like it used to be. But honestly, you know, it was interesting because when I was working on Trek, Babylon 5 was on, and, you know, we kind of turned our nose up at it because the effects were done on an Amiga computer, and they were composite, and they were kind of soft and yucky. But the thing was, because it didn't cost them as much, because doing practical effects, you know, with a motion control rig is expensive, and you got to do 6, 8, 10 passes on the Starship, and then you got to composite them together, one for the windows, one for the phasers, and one for this, and one for that, the whole lighting. So you get a lot of time looking at Captain Picard or Sisko kind of bouncing around on their seat saying fire phasers and the camera rocking back and forth, and then a few seconds of effects. Whereas with Babylon 5, they could really tell the story they wanted to tell, because their effects were cheaper. So if you look at Star Trek Enterprise, which came along years later with Scott, what's his name? The guy who played the captain?
Scott Bakula.
Bakula?
Bakula, yeah.
Yeah. That sounds like Dracula, doesn't it? You look at that show, and CGI had gotten very cheap by then, in comparison anyway, so they are really able to tell. I think it's probably my second favorite of the franchise, because they were able to really tell the story with the visual effects. So I watched a little bit of Star Trek Discovery. I'm watching Picard now. I like it, but I have to say, and maybe it's because it's in 4K, but an awful lot of Discovery, when they get outside the ship, starts looking like a video game to me. Mm. But I think that's more about the design of the effect sequences than it is to do with the fact that they're digital, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that could be. Do you have a favorite spaceship in movies or TV?
I have to say, and I'm prejudiced because I got to work with the Enterprise 1701A model way back in the day. We did a weekend photo shoot for a book cover. And so I came in a little late. Then the guy I was working for it already pulled the model out of the crate and set it up and turned the lights because he knew I was going to gush. So on a hot August day, I walked into this dark soundstage, and there it was in front of me, all 8 feet of this magnificent 1970s second-generation Enterprise. And I damn near broke down and tears fell to my knees. It was so gorgeous. And as you walked up to it, no matter how close you got, it looked real up to 18 inches. It was that good. This is a $180,000 model back in 1978.
Wow.
So I have to say that's probably my all-time favorite. I guess my next favorite would be the Discovery from 2001 Space Odyssey. How about you?
Yeah, I would probably say that 2001 for sure is my favorite.
Now how about for an alien ship?
That's a good question. I don't know. The Klingon ships are always cool.
I really like the D7, which is the old one from the first series, the battlecruiser. And I have pieces of one of those sitting around here that followed me home from my Star Trek days. But I also really thought that first War of the Worlds movie in 1953, that was such an out-of-the-box, brilliant design for that era. They were just gorgeous.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's completely memorable. I mean, it is one of the most memorable alien ships ever.
It is, and as dorky as the movie was in some ways, I don't know about you, but it scared me.
Oh yeah. Oh no, when I was
a
kid,
couldn't sleep that night.
No. When I was a kid, that movie scared me. That movie really scared me. And you know, I'll tell you something: the remake scared me too. With Tom Cruise.
I thought Spielberg
did a great job with that. I thought that movie was really scary.
It was, and I wish they had expanded that big battle scene on the hill a bit. It felt like we kind of got shortchanged there.
Mm-hmm.
But that scene where the train comes hurtling through the frame,
man.
You don't even see any Martians, but this train engulfed in flames comes hurtling through, and it's just so abstract and yet so absolutely indicative of what's going on around them.
Yeah.
That whole thing with
Yeah.
Tim Robbins, that guy looked strange.
Yeah, but that was very weird. It was very, very weird. But yeah, no, I actually am I'm a big fan of that movie. And speaking of Tom Cruise, let's segue into this next subject, which is he's going to work with NASA.
Yeah, so unnamed studio, if any, but apparently NASA and possibly SpaceX, that's the rumor, have come to some kind of agreement with Tom Cruise's production company to film an action film in space. So presumably he'd go up on a SpaceX Dragon 2 capsule, which kind of makes sense because it's bigger than Boeing, so there's a little more room to shoot in there, and that's the kind of thing that you can imagine Elon Musk loving, and Musk was the one that tweeted about it right after the announcement came out, right. So it's kind of like, oh, okay, we can follow the path here. And then he's up on the space station. Now, you know, being weightless in the space station, there's some great stuff you can do. I suppose you can do some karate chops and flying kicks and stuff pretty well in zero-G. What I'm really curious about is, would he train and actually go outside in an EVA suit? Because that takes a lot of practice, and it's really dangerous.
Yeah.
So I would not be surprised if part of that got shot in the studio, but at least he's going up there. I mean, how great is it to be Tom Cruise?
Well, you know, he will do anything. I mean, he will do anything. I mean, some of the stunts that he does, I don't know. I can't imagine what kind of insurance policy that they have on him when he's making movies. I mean,
well, and you know how it is. You know, the attorneys and the insurance adjusters, saying they're wringing their hands, like, you know, in most movies, it's like, okay, you know, don't let George Clooney, like, close the car door himself. He might break a nail, and we can't afford the claim, and we got to shoot tomorrow. Right. And then Cruise is like, you know, going down the freeway at 120 miles an hour, standing on a motorcycle seat on one foot with a girl on his shoulders or something.
Hanging on the side hanging on the side of a plane that's taking off? I mean, what? He's nuts.
And he can do it.
Yeah.
He's a whole different level.
Yeah, he is. So I could see him. Yeah. I could see him going to the space station. No question about it. I mean, that just seems that just seems like a regular day for Tom Cruise.
Well, I imagine even if it wasn't a movie deal, he's probably wealthy enough to buy his own ticket, because I think by then, you know, the couple of years out, it should be, I don't know what the current rate to fly up there when tourists start going up the space station, hopefully this year, maybe next, is going to be about $50 million for the flight. And what do we discuss? It's like $300,000 a day or something. Well, you know.
Yeah.
$30,000 a day. That's chump change for him.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
But it's one wing of his house, you know. So God bless him.
Right.
I mean, that is so exciting.
Rod, hang on, okay?
Yeah.
Rod Pyle is with us, and we've got a couple more stories to talk about. If you want to jump in here with questions concerning space or anything like that, 312-981-7200. Rod's here with us for a little bit longer. 312-981-7200. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Here until 4. We're going to talk about famous animals and where are they now. In Today in History, Dracula by Bram Stoker got released in London. So we're going to talk about the scariest books you've ever read. And much more. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk. And if you want to jump in here, it's 312-981-7200. Rod Pyle is our guest. He's an author, journalist, editor-in-chief at Ad Astra Magazine, and a space expert. There we go. Rod, hey, welcome back.
Thanks, sir.
All right, let's see. We have Tom on WGN. Go ahead, Tom.
Yes, I wanted to ask your guest about the Alcubierre space drive that was being worked on by NASA under the direction of a gentleman by the name, his last name was White, so it's called the Alcubierre White Project, and I wondered if he knows whether that's made any advancements or it's just kind of been shelved.
What do you think, Rod?
So this is Miguel Alcubierre, who was a Mexican physicist who designed a drive that, in theory, and it's completely theoretical, would generate a field around your spacecraft so that effectively you're in normal time space ahead of you is compressed and behind of you is expanded, I think is how it works. So you're basically moving at relativistic speeds, but through space, so you're able to go some significant percentage of the speed of light, but you are actually existing in traditional space-time, so you're not violating the laws of physics. This is all heavily theoretical, and as far as I know, there's been no metal bending done. So I know NASA is interested in such things, but as far as I know, there isn't a significant amount of money being put into it. There is a lot of money being put into other alternative high energy drives, nothing like that, but I mean like nuclear drives and so forth, because we know that chemical rockets have their limits and you can only go so far so fast. You know, it shouldn't take 5 or 7 months to get to Mars. It ought to take a couple of days or a couple of weeks. So when you get into some of these more advanced drives, then it starts paring down the solar system into bite-sized chunks, which is what you want. Mm.
The nice thing about it is that you can't exceed the speed of light, theoretically. But with this space drive, you're not exceeding it, even though you're going
right
5,000 times as faster than the speed of light.
Yeah, it feels a little bit like Schrodinger's cat, doesn't it? It's like, well, you are, but you aren't.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. How does that work? That's kind of confusing.
Yeah.
Now, are you familiar with the Orion project? Do you remember that?
Sure, but that's, I mean, you're blowing off nuclear weapons in back of a ship to propel it, and that's a little bit much in my estimation.
Well, it's funny, you know, they tested it with conventional explosions. So Nick, I think we talked about this before, but it was a great big, they designed a few different versions of it. This is the 50s, late 50s, early 60s. As much as 10,000 or 100,000 or a million ton spacecraft, it looks like a big 50 caliber bullet, that would have this vast store of small nuclear warheads that it would eject out the back, and they go bang, 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 and it propels it at very high velocities. It's a little crude in some respects, the way, depending on how you look at it, but they tested a small mock-up of it with conventional explosions, and it works. So it's been looked at a number of times since the 50s, but this is the kind of thing where you can start moving around the solar system pretty fast, and you can do it in this almost cruise liner comfort of this great big massive spacecraft with these nuclear explosions going off. So I understand your caller's kind of doubts, and I don't know if that would work, but it probably would, but we hope we find a more elegant solution. But I always liked Orion because it was just so in your face.
Yeah. All right, Tom, thank you for the call.
Thank you.
Okay, there you go. Rod, what is this, the China's powerful rocket fell back to Earth and narrowly missed New York City?
Yeah, I mean, narrowly is a bit tight, but yeah, it launched on May 5th, and it's the Long March 5, which can be launched in a couple of different configurations. They call their big rockets Long March, which is named after, you know, this great communist march of survival in the 1930s. So this particular variant had a big central fuselage with four strap-on boosters on the outside. So normally the second stage will go up in orbit. This one sends the biggest part of the rockets, is 20-ton stage, up into orbit, 100 feet long, 16 feet wide. It was supposed to go up, deliver this new prototype space capsule they're building with no crew in it, just a test flight. But it kind of looks like the Apollo capsule, because they've been using a variant of the old Russian design for the Soyuz, and now they're building their own thing from scratch. So did that successfully. It deployed another experiment for some kind of inflatable reentry vehicle successfully. But then apparently they lost control, and it loitered in space longer. And this is kind of a thing with them. This happened with their second space station, too, if you remember, and some other rocket stages. So it came down unpredictably. So it had to come down a few minutes earlier, or maybe it was a few minutes later, I can't remember. It could have hit New York, pieces of it, or it could have hit, apparently tracked over Los Angeles as well, as it is, the pieces fell in some parts of Africa, they think, most of it in the water. But yeah, when you get something that big, even though rockets are actually pretty light, because they are aircraft of a sense after all, then they're pretty thin, it's still a big hunk of metal to come back. We haven't had something the size of that since Skylab in 1979, so it's a little worrisome that happened. Yeah. Interestingly, the Chinese have had other problems. They have some inland, you know, we always launch from the coast out over water, right? They have a couple of inland launch sites where they've actually dropped upper stages on small villages, and in a couple of cases, flattened houses with these very toxic fuels. So,
Jeez. Yeah,
it's something they got to kind of work up and clean up a little bit.
Wow. Okay.
You don't want to be under that.
No. Man, I remember how crazy it was when Skylab.
You remember the hats?
Yep.
The little targets.
People were just like, people were just like losing their minds about where it was going to land.
Yeah, and it was big and heavy too, but it was just an upper stage. This was the entire central booster coming back, which is pretty scary. But actually, Skylab was almost the same size, and I think about it. So, yeah, it's just, you don't like big things falling out of space.
No.
And this is an interesting part of this whole discussion about asteroid mining, by the way, because when you start talking about international treaties, everybody gets nervous when you go out and start nudging space rocks around to bring close to Earth to strip out the resources, because, you know, if you aim it in a certain direction, you could take out a small neighborhood or perhaps a town. So we worry about that.
How often does this stuff, just, we talked about this before, but how often does stuff just fall from the sky?
Well, every day, tons, but most of it's little, it's either dust or, you know, little pea-sized things, which is what causes shooting stars, maybe something up the size of a baseball. Big chunks, not as often. Statistically, we're overdue for a collision of a great big rock on the order of hundreds of yards to miles across, and that gets very upsetting, because even if it only creates a certain size crater, say the size of my hometown, you know, the atmospheric effects last a long time. But if something big lands in the ocean, it basically burns a hole through the ocean, and the water comes caving in behind it, and then you get tsunamis and all that. And the long-term effect is, whether it's on the land or the sea, you get a lot of disturbance in the atmosphere, and now you get something akin, through most scenarios, some kind of nuclear winter. Crops fail, livestock die, and it makes this pandemic look like a Sunday picnic. So, yeah, we really need to start working on spotting these things sooner and getting out there and nudging them off path sooner if they look like they're headed towards Earth, because that's very discomforting.
Do people look in the sky, you know, like are monitoring the sky for that kind of stuff 24/7?
Yeah, the Air Force has a program. NASA has a program. Air Force generally is looking at stuff that's closer in to Earth orbit, but NASA monitors what they call near-Earth objects, which are these big rocks that come hurtling by on a fairly regular schedule. But there's always new ones out there. And the problem is, a lot of them are dark. They're like charcoal dark.
Mm.
So you get a dark rock against a dark sky, you got to have other ways of tracking it. So we need more and better telescopes up in orbit, specifically dedicated to this. But then again, you know, finding was just half the battle. We've done a lot of theoretical work, but never tried to actually nudge one of these things up in space. So there's this mission going up in 2024, 2025 at this point, called DART, the Double Asteroid Redirect Project. And I think we talked about this before. There's an asteroid out there that's being orbited by a smaller moon, its own little moon. The asteroid's Didymos, and the moon is, of course, called Diddy Moon. And DART is basically just going to take a spacecraft to probe and slam it into the smaller of those two bodies, and we're going to look at it and see if it nudges it off course by a couple of fractions of a degree, and if that works, then we know, okay, next time let's use a nuclear warhead or something to nudge it off course, and
we'll
get what we want. Yeah, so, you know, your favorite movies could be coming true sometime not too distant future.
Yeah, that's crazy. All right, Brian.
But you know which one I'm talking about.
Which one?
Is that the space? Was it Space Cowboys? Armageddon, I think.
Armageddon. Oh no, yeah. I don't. Tom likes Armageddon.
He does.
I can't stand that movie.
Tom.
It made. You know how much money that movie made?
Tell me.
Half a billion dollars.
Yeah.
In 1998.
Yeah.
Half a billion dollars.
Yeah.
And it's on Roger Ebert's worst movies.
Yeah.
Ever made.
Because it's a terrible movie.
Rules.
There's no accounting for taste. But Tom does like Independence Day, so, you know, I got to...
He does like Independence Day, too. Yeah. I don't like either of those movies. So, all right.
But I'm with you on one of them, for sure.
Okay, Rod, hold on.
All right.
Rod Pyle is with us. We got another story to talk about here. And if you have any space-related questions, if you want to jump in, we'd love to hear from you. The phone lines are open, 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200 here on... Hi, Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Live in the Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. My guest is Rod Pyle, author, journalist, editor-in-chief at Ad Astra Magazine, and just a great guy in general and a space expert. Rod, welcome back.
Thank you.
Hey, I was just looking on my Facebook feed, and somebody posted a picture of, and it says, this is the neighborhood feud that's happening right now. My neighbor put a United Federation of Planets flag on his house, and the neighbors across the street just raised a Klingon flag. The picture is fantastic. The picture is
great.
It's the house across the street has the Klingon flag. It's great.
So I'm guessing they're both of a certain age, because you'd expect one to be the Federation flag and one to be a Star Wars Rebel flag, right?
Yeah, yeah, I guess. I don't know, but it's a very funny picture.
That is so cool.
Yeah, it's very funny. Starting a little neighborhood feud there, the Klingons versus the Federation.
Get out your disruptors.
All right. Here's Robert on WGN. Hi, Robert.
Good morning, guys.
Hi.
We spend who knows how much money. How come we've never gone, or why haven't we gone back to the moon? Why is this Mars, and they do this? Why haven't we ever gone back to the moon?
That's a really good question. So when we designed the Apollo program, we were in a foot race with the Russians. We were afraid they were going to beat us. So we spent almost 5% of our federal budget up through the late 1960s to get back to the moon. Unfortunately, that meant do it as fast and dirty, as elegant as it was, and as efficiently as possible. And the hardware did very well, but it was just barely enough to get the job done. So the thought was, okay, we made it to the moon. We went 6 times, more if you talk about the orbital missions. And that's it. And then they stopped using the Apollo hardware because they felt they could save money by building this semi-reusable space shuttle, which didn't actually save any money, but that was the idea. So Apollo went bye-bye. So a number of presidents, including both Bushes, have tried to reinvigorate, and again, always Republican administrations for whatever reason, have tried to reinvigorate this idea now with Trump of going back to the moon. I think the main reasons are politically it's kind of difficult to sell this to Congress and the American public unless you've got a good reason to go back. We now have a good reason to go back, which is the Chinese want to send people up there, and they want to mine ice off of the South Lunar Pole because ice in space is very valuable because you can make rocket fuel and air from it. And so there's kind of a new competition heating up. We've got a new adversary, depending on how you look at what an adversary is. We certainly have a new challenger. Now, currently, NASA gets 0.5% of the federal budget, not 5%. So they've got a lot less to work with, and it's a bit of a scramble, and that's where SpaceX and those guys come in to try and save some money.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Well, I appreciate it.
Okay,
thank
Robert.
You, sir.
Take care.
You bet.
Rod Pyle is here, 312-981-7200. So we got a little story about Pluto here.
Is this the weirdest thing?
Tell everybody about this, yeah.
So, I mean, for years, we just saw Pluto as a speck. You know, it was discovered in 1939, Lowell Observatory, Clyde Tombaugh discovers this speck being moving where it shouldn't be. It's not a star, obviously, so it's this distant planet. And then in 2000s, Hubble is able to image it, but it looks kind of like you hit your thumb with a hammer held out at arm's length. It's just kind of bruised model looking, looks like rotten fruit. Then finally, we get the New Horizons mission that does fly by in 2015. And we get these incredible close-up pictures of the planet, still returning data from this mission. Actually, it may be done now, but it took a couple of years to get the data back. So we made a lot of discoveries. One of them is that the surface is much more interesting than we thought. But the other is that apparently, and since 1989, Pluto's been moving further from Earth. It's got this weird offset elliptical orbit that's sometimes close to the Neptune, most of the time further than Neptune. But it's elliptical and offset and kind of tilted with regard to everything else. And it takes 250 years almost for Pluto to make one orbit around the sun. So as it's moving away, it gets really cold out there, billions of miles away from Earth, and 3 billion miles away almost. And apparently at a certain point, the atmosphere actually freezes and collapses onto the surface in the largest ice storm anybody's ever seen, which has got to be incredibly dramatic to see. So they expected that between when they saw it in 2015 and now, it might go down 1% or 2%. Recently, some astronomers did a sighting of what they call an occultation, which is where Pluto passes in front of a star. And we're talking about a speck passing in front of a speck. So this is really high-end astronomy. And we're able to measure the atmospheric density because those guys are geniuses. And it's more like 20%. So they're trying to figure out what makes up the big difference. There's a theory, and it's only a theory at this point, that because we discovered that the surface is much more complex and modeled than we thought, that this one really bright region of ice, when it rotates slowly towards the sun, sublimes and gives more air pressure, and then when it rotates away, it freezes, and even that miniature atmosphere falls back. So they don't know, but that's kind of the puzzle they're trying to figure out. But it's just one of those things that makes space exploration and astronomy so cool, is every time you answer one question, five more pop up.
Yeah.
That's fun.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite planet?
Yeah, Mars. Well, I like Earth a lot.
Well, Earth, yeah, of course. Obviously.
You know, even Detroit is better than anywhere else in the solar system, right? I shouldn't say that, actually. You've got listeners in Detroit. Even Barstow is better than anywhere else in the solar system. That's a desert town out here in California.
Yep.
But I think next best, Mars is cool because there's a thing. I mean, the moon is great, but there's a thing that people are attracted to the idea of standing on another planet. The moon's another world, but it's a hard vacuum. You can see the horizon curving away from you. Talk to guys like Buzz Aldrin, and he'll tell you all about, you know, the dynamics of a near horizon like that and how that messes with you. And it's sterile. But Mars, it's got a thin atmosphere. It looks more like Earth. There's evidence of a lot of water erosion, and there's a lot of water ice under the surface. So you can see doing business there and actually maybe making that another home. So I'd have to say Mars. How about you? Saturn, right?
Yeah, Saturn. Besides Earth, obviously, you know, but Saturn, I always thought, when I was a kid, I always thought it was the coolest looking thing ever.
Well, and you wish you could go, if you could build something on the rings,
mm-hmm.
like, you know, a resort, then Saturn would be it, hands down. But it's, like, saturated with nasty radiation, and it's cold, and it's far away, and the rings are just a big gravel bank of ice. So, turns out it's kind of a crummy place to relocate.
Didn't Pluto get downgraded to a star?
Pluto got downgraded to dwarf planet.
A dwarf planet. Oh, okay.
So it's not even a politically correct term for a small planetoid. So yeah, it. And the guy who did this is Michael Brown at Caltech. I worked with him on a couple articles. I was there, and his Twitter handle is Pluto Kennett. How dare you?
Yeah.
And you know, but he sticks with it because it's got this weird orbit that's kind of offset from the ecliptic where all the other planets go, and it's tilted, and it's inside Neptune's orbit, then it's outside Neptune's orbit, depending on where it is. So it looks like it was captured from the outer solar system, but not the same, didn't form there like a real responsible planet. And he said there's other stuff beyond Pluto that appears to be as big or bigger. So since they're in the same ballpark, I'm downgrading it to a dwarf planet, and people got very upset.
That was a few years back, right?
Yeah, that was probably back in the late 20-aughts.
Yeah.
But and the feud goes on. You know, I think, as I recall, Jim Bridenstine, the head of NASA, went on record as saying, well, it's still a planet to me. So I thought, okay, you got my vote, dude.
Yeah.
Because I like Pluto as a planet. You know, it's just this idea of it being kind of a runt, it just doesn't seem fair.
Yeah. I remember, you know, as a kid when we would study, you know, astronomy, and they had the... You know how they had all the planets hanging from the ceiling of the schoolroom?
Right.
Pluto was always the coolest one. You know, I mean, besides Saturn, Pluto, I always felt bad for Pluto.
Because it was so far away?
So far away, and it was so little.
Yeah, it's pretty puny. It's smaller than the moon.
Oh, it is.
Half.
It is.
Yeah, it's dinky. It's not much of a vacation spot. So, but it's got five of its own moons, so at least it's got enough respect from the solar system to be given five moons. But I think Jupiter is up to, like, I don't know, close to 40 now or something. So,
is that right?
And we just got one, you know? But
yeah.
But it's large. It's really large compared to Earth. So our moon is pretty cool.
Yeah.
And God bless it, because it gives us tides and crazy people.
yeah, you know Tom has to screen the calls here, Rod, and when we get close to a full moon the calls get very interesting. Am I right, Tom?
It can.
Yeah,
it definitely can.
Yeah,
that's any moon. Now, really.
Yeah.
Now, I don't want to get confused with Wolfman, but you were talking about Dracula earlier. Is there any relationship between full moon and vampires, or is it just, I guess it's just werewolves?
It's just werewolves. Yeah.
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 I never read Dracula, did you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a great book.
Yeah.
It is a great book. Yeah.
Absolutely. I got a project now.
Yeah. Okay.
Outstanding.
Well, listen, Rod, always a pleasure. What are you working on now?
I am working on, we had to cancel the National Space Society's International Space Development Conference this year for reasons that we all understand.
Yeah.
So we are doing a kind of a mini virtual version of it that we're calling A Day in Space on July 16th, and I'll get you information on that next time I see you.
Yeah.
And put another issue of the magazine together and try and decide. I'm kind of shuffling. I always do this. You know, I get like a couple of a book started, and then, ooh, this is kind of a cool idea. So I'm kind of ping-ponging back and forth between two or three different ideas. So I've written chapters for all of them, and it's like, okay, which one am I going to do first? So maybe I'll run a contest on Facebook, see what people vote for or something. So I'm trying to decide which one to start on. Oh, and I'm working on, probably be working on another Nat Geo documentary, so that'll be cool.
Oh, very cool. Very, very cool. Yeah. Well, you keep us posted on what's going on, Rod. Always a pleasure, and we'll talk to you next month.
Awesome. Thanks. And okay, let's wish those guys good luck on that launch.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right, Rod, thanks, man. Rod Pyle, always just a great guest. He's an author, a journalist, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra magazine. RodPyleBooks.com is the website. He's written some really great books, and he knows more about space than anybody I've ever spoken to. And he's always a great guest. We always love having him on. Okay, we are going to talk about famous animals and where are they now. So, yeah, and we'll get into that and more. 312-981-7200 if you want to join us.